Tucker, this is our fifth date, and I asked you to write me a little poem just to, you know, give me a sense of what you're feeling. So how did it go?
Yeah, I Googled poem, and I couldn't find anything about it.
Poem, not poeing.
So what I did instead is I had some cranial MRIs done while I was thinking about you. These flashes in the hippocampus are you, I'm pretty sure.
That's so weird and sterile. I need some point of reference. Would you say we're more like Jane Eyre and Rochester, or Elizabeth Bennet and Darcy, or...
Okay, you just started speaking Indonesian for a second there.
Titania and Oberon, or Beatrice and Benedict? I mean, give me something to work with here.
I think I could express it using the Hicks-Marshall Laws of Derived Demand.
What's that?
In economics, it's when the price elasticity of demand for a product being produced is high, then an increase in wages will lead to a large change in the quantity of the final product demanded, affecting employment greatly.
Okay, well, how does that apply to us, you know, as a couple?
You know, a couple of minutes ago, that was totally clear to me. But now I lost the thread of it. I'm not good with analogies.
Big surprise, Tucker. You know, the fact that you never took any humanities courses is really making it hard for us to connect.
Not necessarily. If you hold all of my variables, favorite color, favorite movie, constant, and look only at what happens when relationship satisfaction varies over time, in a sense, you're doing partial differential equations.
Okay, what is your favorite color?
What are the names of some colors?
Forget it. Check, please. He's paying. Today on the show, is there a death watch for the humanities? And now he keeps getting beaten up by the kids from the STEM education program, Colin McEnroe.
And in a sense, we're all being beaten up by the kids from the STEM education program. And that seems to be a process that will repeat itself and increase, at least based on much of what went into the thinking of today's show. Let me just say also that this is an unusual show, and this happens only once in a while, where just based on the promo that ran on the radio, I've started to get quite a few emails. This is a topic that, although it doesn't speak to everybody, and in fact, the point of the show is it doesn't speak to everybody, the people to whom it does speak get pretty worked up about it and want to join the conversation pretty quickly. We have people I can't believe that we were able to get for this show are very excited about it. Let me just kind of tell you who's going to be here. In just a second, you'll meet Stephen Metcalf, a critic and columnist at Slate and host of the Slate Culture Gabfest, which is one of the places that this idea for this show arose from. I'm biting on them one more time. Stanley Fish. Stanley Fish is, you know, one of America's most celebrated public intellectuals, author, scholar, critic, professor of humanities and law at Florida International University. Michael Roth, president of Wesleyan, and his recent work is all about why a liberal education matters. Carolyn Dean, professor of history at Yale, former associate dean of the faculty at Brown. Stuart Parnes, executive director of the Connecticut Humanities Council. I'm telling you, we have an all-star team here. So you're going to get to meet them all. We are talking about this question. And our first guest is going to sort of set the table for us on this. This question about whether, in fact, the humanities, the teaching of the humanities, and we're talking about philosophy, literature, religion, art, music, history, language, is beginning to wane, not even beginning to wane, but in full-fledged wane. And if so, whether that matters. A lot of this does, a lot of our current conversation does arise from this one seminal report called The Heart of the Matter. Joining us right now is Hunter Rawlings, a member of the Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission, president of the AAU, Association of American Universities. He is going to set the table for us by explaining The Heart of the Matter, what this report is about. Hunter Rawlings, welcome. And maybe just to begin, this report, although we're going to be talking a lot about what happens on college campuses, in this report, you go sort of deeper into the first stirrings of education, right? And just sort of talk about whether the humanities are being imparted throughout a student's education.
Yes, indeed. We are concerned with the humanities throughout education, K-12, college, community college, and so on, because we think the humanities are important at every stage of life, actually.
In general, the sort of the alarming stuff seems to come towards the end of the report in the so-called research section. But in general, I mean, as you took the temperature of our population vis-a-vis the humanities, what did you find?
Well, in general, I'd say the humanities are pretty healthy overall because many, many students take humanities courses. What's down, and everyone notices this, is the percentage of students taking humanities as a major. And that is clear, but part of the reason for that is we're educating far more people at college than we used to. And many of those additional folks who are now in college are there for essentially vocational reasons. So they're pursuing a business degree or a communications degree and don't get drawn to the humanities as much as other students might.
But in this report, you even talk about questions about whether parents read to their children as much as they used to. I mean, as we say, we can look at sort of majors at the college level and stuff like that, but it doesn't start there. It goes back into childhood. You suggest in the report that, in fact, parents don't read as much to their children.
I think there's some data for that, in fact. So it's quite possibly true, and with the rise of the Internet, it's not too surprising that reading perhaps is down. On the other hand, I would also point out that reading groups among adults across the country seem to be incredibly vibrant and numerous. So every time you can point to some problem, you can also point, I think, to a benefit and an advantage.
It's interesting hearing you talk and looking at the report. For some reason or other, this report touched off kind of a different reaction among academics, among people who care about the humanities. They look at that report and say, oh, no, this is basically the chronicle of our death foretold. Why are they seeing it that way?
Well, ever since I entered academia, which is many, many decades ago, I'm afraid, I've been hearing about the crisis in the humanities. So I don't think it's too different today from the way it was 30 or 40 years ago. Perhaps a little different because, as I said, the percentage of students majoring in the humanities is down, noticeably down. But I think that over the decades, the humanities have always engendered this feeling that somehow they're losing ground. And as a professor myself, I used to hear that a lot. On the other hand, students sign up for humanities courses in droves, and they tend to like their humanities courses quite a lot. In fact, much more than they tend to like some of the courses in other disciplines. So, again, I think it's sort of mixed picture, and what we were trying to do in the report is bring a lot of this to the forefront. And we're especially concerned, I think, that there's so much emphasis politically now upon vocational education and a real sense that there's an attack, a political attack, in fact, on the value of the humanities. So that's one of the things we're trying to address.
When you say a political attack, what do you mean?
Well, you've probably seen statements by a number of different governors, for example, saying that they feel that courses in the humanities are not of much value to students in their state's universities. Some have even called for making humanities majors pay more in order to give them a disincentive for majoring in the humanities. We're seeing a tremendous emphasis upon jobs, jobs, jobs for graduates as soon as they get out of college. All of that, it seems to us, is aimed at saying the humanities are not as important as other subjects might be.
I think this is a good transition. First of all, Hunter Rawlings, thank you so much for this. We're going to discuss this at greater length. This is a good transition, I think, into Stanley Fish and Stephen Metcalf, who are both going to join us right now. And I do feel as though in reading some of the kinds of statements that he's talking about, there's a whole bunch of code words. They include competitiveness and productivity. Those seem to apply only to the so-called STEM areas, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Competitiveness and productivity do not relate somehow, rhetorically anyway, to the humanities. So let's begin with Stanley Fish. Stanley Fish, first of all, honored to have you on the show. And second of all, some of your writing suggests that as far as the humanities goes, the wall has already been breached and the Ostrogoths are sacking the city. Hunter Rawlings notwithstanding, how far into the decline and fall of the humanities are we?
Well, I think we're fairly far into the decline and fall of the humanities. I would agree with President Rawlings that the humanities have been lamenting their own situation for many years. What's different is a structural difference, both internal and external. Internal, that is, in the area of the universities themselves, we've lost several things, we being humanities professors and students. One of them are distribution requirements. One of the things we've lost is distribution requirements. Professor Rawlings spoke of people who choose the humanities or don't choose the humanities as a major. But it used to be the case that because of distribution requirements, students didn't have choice, and I think that was a better model. I don't have any interest in coddling student choices. Rather, students were asked to take a set of courses that were deemed valuable and important by administrators and teachers. And therefore, they would end up in a Shakespeare course or a romantic poetry course, whether they wanted to or not. That's no longer the case. And then, of course, externally, all of the factors that President Rawlings and others have indexed, that is the rush to vocationalism, the withdrawal, the massive withdrawal of funds from public universities by state legislatures at the same time that the demand for the product, higher education, has risen. That's a very bad combination. So you have an internal lack of will to maintain strength in the humanities and an external, indeed sometimes political, assault on the humanities.
Well, you know, it's not just distribution requirements. I went back and found one of your pieces at the time that the president of SUNY Albany announced that French, Italian, classics, Russian, and theater programs were essentially being shut down. I mean, it wasn't even a matter of distribution requirements. The programs weren't there anymore.
Yes, in fact, they weren't there. But why weren't they there? They weren't there because, in part, the requirements that would, and let's use the word because it is the correct word, force students into those courses were no longer in place. I looked at the requirements at SUNY Albany at the time, and they were so generous, or one might say loose, that a student could easily avoid taking many humanities courses. Again, what I'm arguing for is an artificial shoring up of the humanities by requirements and also by distribution requirements and also by a decision on the part of administrators to fund the humanities no matter what they contribute or don't contribute to the bottom line. That used to be the case. It's no longer the case.
Stephen Metcalf, you are so passionate about this, you're taking time out from your beach vacation to participate in the show. And listening to your comments on the Slate podcast, I got the feeling that first of all, you also believe that there's a kind of death watch on as opposed to a period of watching an army come charging over the hill towards the city.
Yeah, I think that's right. The one piece of counter evidence that in absolute numbers there may be as many or more people now taking humanities courses as there were 20 or 40 years ago, it's really only the relative numbers that are baleful and depressing. I personally don't buy that argument. When I read in the New York Times that there are only 16 English majors graduating from Pomona College, a liberal arts college with a tremendous history. I happen to know a poet on the staff there, Bob Mezzi, a tremendous poet who's been teaching there for a generation. He's seen that decline up close. I mean, you know, vitality tends to be a relative indicator very often, and people sense when something is diminishing relative to the whole, regardless of what the absolute numbers are. I would pick up on, a couple things. One is that I would say, first of all, I'm honored to be on the same program with Stanley Fish. You know, one of the most extraordinary moments in my sort of pathetically extended career as a graduate student was going to a lecture that Richard Rorty, the great American, late American philosopher, was offering. And a guest lecturer was Stanley Fish. And watching these two, I really honestly think it's fair to say titans of the humanities, up close. That's an extraordinary experience. It says something to both the status, the world-class status of our institutions as research institutions, but it also speaks to something that makes everyone squirm, which is their pastoral function, their ability to reproduce in a new generation highly literate, deep thinkers. And you see this in the report that we're discussing itself. I think its most interesting conflict is between its desire to say that the virtue of the humanities is their inutility and vice versa. At the same time, they want to say their virtue is in their utility, their ability to compete in some, measurable way with business and economics. And I think you get caught between those two things. The one says that they're indicates at least that they're merely a luxury, and the other indicates, that they can be placed on a common scale with these highly utile, high utility function vocational programs, and they can't.
One of the things that you said, and I want to hear what Stanley Fish says in reply to it, one of the things you said on the Slate podcast is that in a way the humanities linguistically priced themselves out of the market. They began to trade in this kind of exclusionary, hyper-abstruse language that and no wonder Stanley Fish thinks we have to force people to go to the humanities because they became less and less attractive to any clear-thinking person because of their own behaviors. Once again, setting aside the incredible vitality and clarity of Richard Rorty or Stanley Fish, but just, you know, day in, day out, what happens in a lot of these departments. And you want to expand on that, Stephen Metcalf, and then we'll hear what Stanley Fish says too.
Yeah, what I would say is that in order to gain institutional self-respect, it was the humanities perceived that it was important for them to have highly specialized, you know, highly discrete disciplines that were internally regulated and that spoke something like a common professional language in order to regulate hiring practices, advancement practices, and that lingua franca turned out to be literary theory, right? It was the common language that virtually everyone speaks. Everyone needs to produce a monograph in order to, in order to latch on as a junior professor. It's a kind of a non-negotiable requirement. How does every monograph in the humanities that I have ever looked at that was written in the last 30 years or certainly 20 to 25 years start? It starts by quote-unquote positioning the argument that the author is going to make, prospectively going to make, right? And that means saying, I have read all the requisite texts by Bourdieu, Foucault, and Derrida. I understand how, you know, my specific apprehension of Toni Morrison or Milton fits in with each one of these paradigms. And the problem with that is, though maybe it works as a way of internally regulating the professional, you know, advancement policies of the professoriate, of the department itself, it creates a language that's completely uninteresting to the outsider, to the person who's external to the inner machinations of the department, right? Unless you yourself want to become similarly professionalized and you yourself want to become a humanities professor, that language is relatively uninteresting. I agree, and I'm sure Professor Fish would agree, that very many of those texts migrate from being secondary to primary texts that we can now begin to see with the removal of a generation and a half that Derrida and Foucault are philosophers in their own right. That's fine. But the use of these kind of highly theoretical, you know, in-speak paradigms with which to apprehend literature, most undergraduates, most generally educated people find these extremely alienating.
Stanley Fish, I'm just going to let that ball drift over the net in your direction. What about that highly theoretical in-speak of academic language?
Well, first of all, let me say that I grew up in the tradition of close reading, something I still practiced. And so when the theory revolution, so-called, hit in the late 60s and early 70s, I had already been in the profession for a while. And I'm going to tell you that for me and for others, the introduction of theory was absolutely energizing and exciting. Because what it did, and it did this across areas, including areas in science and the social sciences, what theory did was to historicize the routines, the professional routines that we had all accepted as the result of our graduate student educations. Theory asked us to ask ourselves, well, why is it that these are the questions? Why is it that these are the canonical approaches? Where did they come from? What assumptions? What affiliations? And in some cases, what politics underlies the structure of professional life? So I think that the theory revolution, although it took some unhappy turns and was fetishized by some people, was in general an absolutely great thing. The word that Mr. Metcalf used that I would seize on, and he used it several times, is professional. The tension is between the professional study of the humanities, which is an academic matter, and a general interest in the humanities, which is, of course, an interest proven by the fact that there are so many Shakespeare festivals, poetry festivals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The professional study of the humanities is what the academy does, and the lack of a relationship between what professional humanists do and what the general public is interested in seems to me to be of no consequence at all, and no one should pay any attention to it.
I want us to stop there and just say, Stanley Fish, imagine that I'm the governor of Texas, but I'm not Rick Perry, or I'm the governor of South Carolina. I'm the governor of somewhere. Tell me in plain language why I should pressure my budget people, my higher education people, my state legislature to fund the humanities. Why is that important? Because I, as governor, understand why all this STEM stuff is important, because it's all about business and competitiveness. It's all about research funding. I get all that stuff. Why should I care about philosophy, literature, religion, art, music, history, language? What's that worth to me?
What you're asking for is justification. When the demand for justification comes to you, you should turn around and run as fast as you can in the other direction. Because justification is a demand that always comes from the other fellow's playing field, not yours. What you're being asked to do is justify what you do on his terms rather than on your own terms. I have no answer in that conversation to the governor or to the member of legislators. I used to talk to the legislators at Illinois when I was a dean, and what I would do is interrogate them. What do you know about what we do? Suppose I was to come into your shop, whatever it is, and after 45 minutes tell you why you should not be doing what you do and why I know better, you'd throw me out in 5 minutes. All of these people, governors, state legislatures, and many boards of trustees are acting out of ignorance. And the way to combat them is to make them feel ashamed, which I can do extremely well.
Well, there's a Dale Carnegie piece of this that's missing somehow. I don't know, Stephen Metcalf, is that an adequate response, or does academia, do the humanities need to be able to articulate to the Philistines at the state capitol why they should be there?
Well, I mean, with all due respect to Professor Fish, he did have an exemplary career. He is, you know, still continuing on an exemplary career that began in the golden age of academia, of the humanities, you know, beginning with, you know, the GI Bill in the 40s and the radical expansion of the, you know, student population through the 60s. And such a career paradigm is just completely unavailable now. And the idea that we're now at a point where the relative power relations allow for a dean of an English department or the head of an English department to go to a funding dean and say and shame them because of their ignorance of what, you know, internally the department does, and that's going to somehow provide the funding to keep the English department going at its current strength. It's just not going to happen.
Because the dean should be on your side, as should it be every other administrator in the university. The university's administration has the responsibility for presenting the case to outside constituencies. When I talked about going to legislators and going to governors, or governor ever responds well to a university administrator who comes
hat in hand.
But when you come in ready to kick their ass, they respond.
All right. Well, go ahead, Stephen Metcalf. And then we have to, I know, we promised both of you you'd be out at 1:30. Who knew you were going to engage in this?
Let me just quickly point out that two things that Mr. Fish said, that Professor Fish says, are in total contradiction with one another. You know, the first is that he says that there ought to be some form of core curriculum with humanities requirements that put asses in the seats of these lecture halls, regardless of whether the student at the age of 18 or 19 wants to be there. Okay, and then secondly, he says that we should leave as sacrosanct the internally policing disciplinary methods of the humanities departments themselves. The problem is, as he himself knows from his experience at Duke University, is that when you get a highly professionalized celebrity department together of humanities superstars, they infight. And they infight in such an internecine fashion that they can't even agree what the nature of their own common discipline is. The idea that those people are in turn going to create a core curriculum that is politically acceptable to each one of them, that you can then foist upon undergraduates, is ridiculous.
Well, I'm not asking for a core curriculum that has a basis either in philosophy or virtue. I'm asking for a core curriculum that has a basis in professional survival. What you should want to do as a professional is set up conditions so that the exercise of your profession is as successful as possible. Forget about the morality. Forget about the philosophy. Just act in ways which protect your interests.
You know, we're going to let Stephen Metcalf go look for starfish and Stanley Fish go off and shame some state legislators. Let me just grab one quick call from a caller. And then in the next segment, we're going to have Michael Roth from Wesleyan, Carolyn Dean from Yale. Maybe it'll be another steel cage match. I somehow or other doubt that. But here's Julia Pestel. Hi.
Hi. Hi. I'm just calling to mount a general defense of the humanities. I think it's an interdisciplinary world, and I think when we think about the humanities, we often think mostly of the arts, but as I was sitting and considering the show, I was thinking about religious studies and how important they are to keep in our political forefront now. So the more people who are doing close and theoretical reads of religious texts, the better. In my opinion.
Great point. I mean, one of the points that I made in an introduction to this show that ran before the news, I'm going to say it again, and particularly because I know that Michael Roth and Carolyn Dean are on hold and listening too, and maybe it kind of can set up part of the discussion we have in the next segment. You don't really need to look very far to see why the humanities are important and why there's some kind of humanities fail going on right now. In the news in the last, 72 hours, we have terrible wildfires in Arizona, deadly, wind-driven wildfires. And then you have sort of the description of all that as the new normal, this very dangerous and frightening climactic situation. We have the science to know what's wrong. We have the science to know what we could do to at least slow the advance of what's wrong. What we seem not to have is the value system to do anything about it. And that's a humanities fail. That's why if we can't think of ourselves in communities, if we can't think of lives lived in the future as equivalent to lives lived now, if we don't have all these things that the study of the humanities provides us with, then you get what you've got right now. Anyway, we're all worked up about this. This is exciting. We'll take a little break. We'll be back. We're going to take a break right now. We're on tape today, so if you try to call in, you will be frustrated. We're actually having a meeting right now about how to make the show even more fabulous and fascinating for you. Here, we're exploring the health of the humanities. Are young people flocking to fields where super colliders and cranial MRIs unlock the mysteries of life in a way that great books do not? And come back tomorrow when the nose comes back from watching 12 Years a Slave and talks about that movie, the NFL bullying controversy, and about how the word dude became popular. My feeling is that we shouldn't put the show online yet, because I think we could sell as sort of a pay-per-view or pay-per-listen thing the Stephen Metcalf, Stanley Fish clash there, particularly to fans of the Slate Culture Gabfest. I'm thinking we could get $9.99 per download. So let's monetize this. Are the humanities dying? Does it matter? Well, that sounds very like a radio topic, the way I just framed it. I apologize for that. We're going to talk now to the people who are at universities here in the state of Connecticut, who are grappling with these questions as well. Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University. Carolyn Dean is professor of history at Yale, formerly associate dean of faculty at Brown University. Michael Roth, one of your cherished topics is why liberal education matters. It's your current book. It's a lecture that you've given around the world, I believe.
Yes.
And including in Beijing. Why does liberal education matter?
Well, I'm very amused to listen to the first half of the show.
Not as amused as I was. But
two people I admire a lot, but they trade in nostalgia, as we humanists often do. They think, well, it's not like it used to be when I was in a great seminar. It's not like it used to be when in the heyday of the theory and of subsidized graduate education in the 60s and 70s. I mean, at Yale, they were promoting this problem in the 1820s, in the 1920s, with the rise of sciences. Everybody was freaking out about whether the humanities still had a place, and it's happening again now. The numbers don't show at all a crisis in the humanities. Unless you pick a starting point at the highest level of humanities enrollments, otherwise it's pretty stable. I know at Wesleyan it's very stable, and so I think that what we do see in the United States at times of economic anxiety, which are frequent here, and economic ambition, is questioning about whether a well-rounded education is worth it. That's a phrase we hear all the time. Is it worth it? Is it worth the investment? At the same time, in our current economy, people who have enormous success in inventiveness and creativity and surprising discoveries are people who often, not always, but often, have an education from which they can draw in a variety of ways. This is not your grandparents' education. In the 1820s, they worried about the loss of Latin and Greek. In the 1920s, they worried about whether scientific philology was going to keep going. Today, we're worrying about whether theory and really jargon-filled literary criticism has destroyed the humanities. I think that's nonsense. At Yale, at Wesleyan, at UConn, there are great humanities classes in English, in history, in philosophy, in religion, that attract lots of students because they look at eternal questions that have plagued us for a long, long time in ethics and philosophy of language and of knowledge, and they also look at contemporary issues that we have a hard time figuring out because they don't have a simple technical answer. And if you don't believe there's a simple technical answer to the most important questions, then the humanities and a liberal education is for you.
You know, I mean, first of all, on the one hand, I want to agree with you that I graduated from Yale in 1976 when Kingman Brewster had coined the phrase grim professionalism to describe my class of students. And he was not wrong. I was one of the few people who really cared about the humanities, and I'm virtually unemployable now. But 20 years later or 15 years later, we saw the incredible rise of the MBA. You know, that was sort of, once again, a lot of breastbeating about that basically the MBA was now seen as the ticket to riches and business preparation, therefore, was the ticket to the MBA, and that was kind of what was going on. So to some degree, these things go in cycles. And I want to hear both of you on this next question, but I'll start with you, Michael Roth. On the other hand, I have this kind of intuitive and therefore, you know, not satisfyingly backed up by Nate Silver-type statistics feeling that an undergraduate finishing a four-year degree in the 1970s, 1960s, 1950s probably did have a better grasp or was more likely to have a pretty good grasp of Socrates, Milton, Kant. Now I'm naming all dead white males. Maybe that's part of the problem. But, you know, that sort of that canonical core curriculum of the humanities was, you know, no matter what the statistics said about the majors, that this kind of basic understanding of thought and literature and art as a core understanding was better absorbed decades ago than it is today.
Well, that's and with people who looked at you who graduated 20 years before thought, well, not intuitively, as you say, that is with prejudice, oh, when I graduated, we were a lot smarter, we knew this stuff better.
And they were right, too. They were completely right.
What are you supposed to do? You're an old guy like me. I graduated around the same time you did, and I do look at my students. I say, oh, my God, what they don't know. And they look at me and say, oh, my God, what he doesn't know. You know, Carolyn and I are both historians, and I think you have to try to see these things in historical perspective. There are economic issues facing the humanities, government funding dropping off not only in the humanities but in many fields of basic research in favor of, you know, quick fixes, quick utilitarian research that's supposed to solve an immediate issue. That's in the long run going to be damaging to our culture and our economy. But I think we have to avoid the nostalgia of saying, you know, when I was younger, people wrote better, they read more deeply, and they had giants in the seminar room. I mean, I think that's just... That's embarrassing, actually. I mean, if you study the humanities, you should realize something about history and the ability of people of a certain age to generate nostalgia. We, I think, have to create exciting, dynamic humanities courses across these disciplines to attract students who are still interested in questions of meaning and questions of human purpose in relations with the natural world, and questions of multiculturalism. I gave one of these massive open online courses, Great Books Humanities course this year. I had 30,000 people sign up for it from around the world. I was shocked that an old-fashioned, Eurocentric Great Books course would attract so many students in China, in India, in South America. And I think it shows that there's an enormous appetite for what liberal education provides and an enormous interest in the humanities.
So, Carolyn Dean, do you agree with your friend President Roth? Is all this talk of a crisis in the humanities just talk?
Yeah, sadly, I would have to say that we're probably not going to engage in the kind of battle we saw the last half hour.
It was too much to hope for to have
it might
a choice.
Be better for you, but or more interesting for the audience, but I would agree with Michael. And I, as a historian, too, let me approach it a little differently, which is to say that it strikes me that what's changed over time, aside from the cyclical nature of these questions, is that right now, at least, the kind of literacy necessary that is perceived to be necessary for job growth, for becoming a functional citizen in the United States and in the world today, is a certain kind of scientific literacy rather than a humanities literacy. And these things are always opposed to each other, as if, first of all, science were reducible to technical matters. And it strikes me that, in fact, nobody yet has pointed out that if I were a scientist on this show right now, I would be rather shocked at the caricature of my own discipline and my particular ways of thinking. I would be shocked that I was being reduced to having technical solutions to immediate problems, that I was somehow less specialized than humanists are, that I have a lot to give is axiomatic right now, but that I somehow don't spend a lot of time thinking and wondering asking big questions, and that I need humanities to help me to formulate what those questions are. And I think that, so I guess I would like to say that it seems to me that this is part of a much larger paradigm shift in the kinds of questions that we're asking culturally, about what kind of literacy is necessary. And that's a very, very instrumental question to ask about the nature of knowledge production.
I think that's a great point. And the notion that there's a severance between the thinking that's intrinsic to the humanities and the thinking that's intrinsic to the sciences is a relatively new development in the history of mankind. I mean, John Stuart Mill wouldn't have any idea what we were talking about.
Correct.
On the other hand, there are those who do see there as being some kind of severance. But let me just push a little bit at the sort of the cold, hard facts of this. Maybe one of the first questions I'll ask both of you is it possible that Brown, Yale, and Wesleyan are not good canaries for this coal mine? In other words, if the liberal arts, if the humanities are going to survive anywhere, they're going to survive there. Whereas, I don't know, just symbolically, I'm noticing at the University of Connecticut that there's a $2.1 billion STEM program starting up or proposed for the University of Connecticut. At the same time, the president has funded a $100,000 humanities scholarship. I'm not suggesting that those ratios are in some way emblematic of what's going on. But, you know, really, science and technology, in terms of money, in terms of resources, particularly probably at public universities, that's where the action is. So why shouldn't that be worrisome in an environment where Stanley Fish can point to situations where entire majors are wiped out at state universities?
It is worrisome. The funding imbalances of today, like the funding imbalances actually in the 1960s and 1970s, are very much tilted towards those fields that are a lot more expensive, actually. And so I think that, as Carolyn pointed out, the more we can do to show the ways in which the sciences, humanities and social sciences, are productively linked together, the more possible it'll be for those working in humanities and social sciences to have adequate funding. We don't need the same kind of funding that you need to do stem cell research. Just one other issue here that I think is really important over the last 30 years is the change in the demography of higher education, where the dramatic increase in the number of women in colleges and universities, and also people from previously underrepresented groups. And that puts an interesting and productive pressure on the humanities. It also has an impact on the way we teach sciences. And I think part of what we're seeing is the ways universities react to the changes in the kinds of students we're teaching today, as opposed to a very homogeneous population that was more inclined to accept a stable canon of authors.
Carolyn Dean, you may have your own specific response to this, but let me just sort of also put another thing out on the table I'd love for you to respond to, too. Is there a danger here that, you know, I mean, one of the sort of final insults of this whole conversation was, in fact, last week, Nate Silver in the New York Times, who kind of is the STEM guy that, you know, all the humanities nerds really look up to and respect and count on to sort of quantify some of the things that they want to actually some hard data about. But he basically did write a refutation of this argument that the humanities are in trouble. He used numbers, as he always does, to back up that supposition, and refuting Verlin Klinkenborg's piece in the New York Times. But, you know, within that, it was this notion that there's this expanded clientele of universities. More and more people go to college. And a lot of it's sort of aspirational, too. It's a lot of people who wouldn't have been able to go to college or wouldn't have contemplated college in the past go now. But they go often to prepare themselves for careers. So they're going to start selecting courses that prepare themselves for careers. Once again, I don't think this is happening at Brown and Wesleyan and Yale quite as much as it's happening at two-year colleges and publicly funded four-year colleges. And I wonder if there's a danger that we're getting, just to go back to the whole question of demographics, a kind of two-tier system where the humanities gets taught to one group, and the other group, because they're pretty focused, they've got their eyes on their prize, they're focused on moving up a rung socioeconomically, they just don't get that part of the education.
I don't know that that's true. I think statistically, of course, Nate Silver was correct, and Michael's repeated that, but I think that the most important thing that he noted was the demographic change in higher education, and I think it's a misnomer to think that elite schools, while obviously they're elite and they still teach to a certain kind of student body, they've over time been pioneers, and especially right now, in trying to diversify the student body they do teach to give increasing numbers of people access to what we call elite education in a period of rising income inequality. Secondly, I think it's really important to note that the diversity question itself overall requires the kinds of questions, big questions that humanists are taught to respond to more than scientists. And it seems to me that this is a challenge. So I wouldn't say that this is not a good question. It's an excellent question. I wouldn't say there's no problem in the way that Michael responded to the earlier speakers by saying, you know, you can't pretend that nothing has changed. There are huge changes, and federal priorities and popular perceptions are very crucial. But there certainly is a role for elite education. Yale has quite realistically got a Mellon grant to begin to prepare graduate students for jobs that are not academic by encouraging collaboration and cross-disciplinary research. So I think that these are the kind of things that elite institutions can do that more vocational institutions are not even meant to do. But certainly public education across the United States isn't just turning out students who know exactly what they want to do. The idea of liberal arts education is to allow for exploration, and the more politicians cannot hear that message, the poorer American education will be, and that itself is a crisis. The fact that we're specializing to the extent that we do, and are thinking so instrumentally about education means that we are not doing very well internationally in educating our students, and that's why the big report from the AAAS was all about, had a lot of emphasis on K-12. So arguments have to be made at every level. That's what I would say. I mean, I don't know what Michael thinks.
I would agree with that. I think that when politicians start creating incentives to steer people to narrow fields of study, what they're really hoping to do is create incentives for conformity.
Yeah.
Stop exploration, because when people explore things, they ask questions. When people ask questions, they actually realize the politicians who are supposed to represent them are actually doing a terrible job. So the attempt to eliminate exploration from higher education in favor of some narrow specialization for yesterday's jobs is really trying to instill conformity in higher education, just like No Child Left Behind instilled conformity in K-12. I think this is something we have to resist. Scientists have to resist it just as much as English professors, because conformity and groupthink is the enemy of discovery and research.
I
do think politicians, it's in their interest to promote conformity.
I
add one thing. Very people, the very politicians that want to cut funding to humanities, they're also cutting funding to the sciences, by the way, the research sciences.
It's
they also show an incredible ignorance of how science works. And let me just give you one. I know we're out of time. One quick example would be, if I read another article in the New York Times about how none of the studies done thus far are really legit from a scientific point of view, and yet the public starts eating X food or not eating X food because of of a series of studies that are done at funded at millions of dollars that are not conclusive, and the public wants conclusions. And I think that that's a perfect example of how science is a far less special, a far more complex way of thinking than its popularization, than the politicians make it out to be. In the same sense, I would also say that scientists work on one little thing their whole lives, and because they know how to ask really important questions about that little thing, they are able to make big discoveries, as Michael was saying. If humanists, when they're focusing on one small thing, they're somehow useless and superfluous. And I find that the fact that science is given this kind of carte blanche to be important because there is a concept historically that what it's producing is tangible is not only it's not accurate entirely.
You know, we're going to have to go just because we're completely out of time. Carolyn Dean, thanks so much for that. I don't know. It seems like there's more of a crisis at the end of this particular segment than there was at the beginning. I could be just imagining that. It's my humanities skills at work. Michael Roth and Carolyn Dean, thank you so much. We have a little bit of time on the other side. We've got a lot of calls up on the board. I'd like to get to a few of them if I can.
Robert Frost did write in settings beautiful and rustic. He wrote of rolling hills and green.
My scientific calculations suggest that it would take far longer than the age of the universe for monkeys using typewriters to randomly produce a flawless copy of the works of Shakespeare, although I still haven't been able to establish what a typewriter is. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our interns Andrew Gates and Emily Boucher, and stern but fair supervision by Eva Tinkala. The part of Bill Curry was played by Harold Bloom. And now, back to Colin.
Harold Bloom actually turned us down for this show, but he turned us down with an email that said, "I'd prefer not to." I thought it was great that he was sort of Melvillian even in turning us down. All right. I've totally screwed up the clock. They were too much for me. They overwhelmed me, those academics. Stuart Parnes is with us for a criminally small amount of time. He's executive director of the Connecticut Humanities Council. Stuart Parnes, you've been listening to some of this conversation unfold during the show. The Connecticut Humanities Council has a slightly different mission, I would say, than a university. But as you listen to everything that was just said, I mean, how much of it is sort of real in your experience, particularly the degree in which the sciences and the humanities are placed in opposition to one another, at least for funding purposes?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, a lot of us feel that this is sort of an artificial point because we can't do with either one or the other. We really need both halves of this. But I love the discussion you've been having, and I'm glad actually to be a little distant from it. Our offices in Middletown are literally just down the hill from the Wesleyan campus.
Mm-hmm.
But we live in another world. I mean, our job is to actually bring humanities to the streets, you know, take programming out around the state and support organizations that are humanities organizations in our communities. So we listen carefully, we smile and listen to our academic colleagues as they go through this kind of hand-wringing, and it's been fabulous. This report that's come out has provided for some terrific debate over this issue, which brings it to the forefront, and that doesn't happen very often.
Well, I mean, and from your point of view, though, I mean, it sort of goes back to something that Stanley Fish said. The kind of stuff that you do, for the most part, is incredibly popular. People really like it.
It really is, and I think, you know, the comment that Stanley made about the tension between the professional and the general humanities worlds. Well, we're very much generalists. We're in the world. We do so much around the state and do it to really interested audiences. And they're not all, you know, former liberal arts students. We reach mixed audiences in cities and towns all across Connecticut. And we do it for you know, sort of a bit less fancy and a little less a sense of academic accomplishment than we do out of a real concern for building communities. We feel that the humanities are absolutely essential to strong communities around this state and everywhere. And what we work on is sort of civil discourse and trying to connect people, different kinds of people, around great ideas, often great books. But there's a huge place for this.
Right, Stuart. Unfortunately, I got to go. They destroyed my clock. Those high powered academics.
That's a shame. Well, catch us.
All right, we'll do a whole other Connecticut Humanities Council Street Humanities show. If you didn't get to talk today, email me. Everybody else did. Colin, Colin at wnpr.org. That's Colin, wnpr.org.
I'm Kyone Wolf. Two roads diverged in a wood. And I plugged in some coordinates into my GPS and didn't worry about it because it's impossible to gauge the difference between taking the road less traveled and the one that's well traveled because there's no observable parallel universes to compare. Everybody knows that.